adventure, the Shasta Renaissance and Fantasy Fair on May 24th and 25th. The Anderson Fairgrounds transforms into a realm of knights, jesters, and magic. Watch thrilling armored combat, enjoy lively Celtic and folk music, feast like royalty, and shop handcrafted treasures from artisans far and wide. Tickets are just $15 for adults, $13 for youth, $11 to $17, and kids 10 and under. Get in free. Get yours now at Eventbrite and skip the lines. Proudly sponsored by Shasta Stalls, your local consignment gift shop featuring unique finds, handcrafted goods, and arts and craft classes at 2185 North Street in Henderson, and Reading Anime, your hub for anime, gaming, and pop culture in the North State. And Creature Comforts, the rock and roll barbershop at 2181 North Street in Anderson, where you can get a fresh cut and enjoy a free beer while you wait. Don't miss out on the magic. Join us May 24th and 25th at the Shasta Renaissance and Fantasy Fair. Hoorah!
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday Mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
You have a choice when it comes to your cancer care, and I want you to know that at Valor Oncology, we are here to provide the best possible care right here in Reading. I'm Dr. Lauren Strickland, Valor's breast oncology surgeon, and I'm proud to serve this community that I call home. When you come to Valor Oncology, you'll see the same dedicated team at every visit, physicians who know your history and are committed to your care. We offer state-of-the-art technology that rivals major cancer centers, combined with the personalized care you deserve. We are not just a team of doctors. We are part of the fabric of this community, and we are here for you today and tomorrow. When it comes to your health, you deserve expert care, compassion, and stability. Ask your doctor to refer you to Valor Oncology, because we're committed to you and we're committed to Reading. Call 530-900-4000 or visit valor.org to schedule a consultation. Valor Oncology, rooted in Reading, focused on you.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. 27 years ago, my wife Judy and I started Shasta Gas with the help and under the direction of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, we believe He is the owner and we are simply the managers. Through the years, we have received many offers from major national corporations to buy Shasta Gas, but our commitment has always been to be and remain locally owned and family operated. Our daughter Karen Wehunt and her husband Jason now manage the daily operations of Shasta Gas and Shasta Tanks, a new business we started a few years ago. We now have the third generation of family members working in the business. Sunshine Stevens, our granddaughter, and her husband Adam, and our grandson Jason. Our commitment and motto are still the same. Our customers are warm friends. To support locally owned family operated business, please call Shasta Gas Propane at 530-365-3793. That's 530-365-3793.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So, what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
drills got much more serious. And that whole winter, there was a lot of serious work going on to prepare the Minutemen to participate in battles which they feared were all too likely.
Take us down that road a little bit farther on the Minutemen. Who were these Minutemen? What was the average American militia like around this time?
Well, in New England in particular, it was the adult males. John Adams said there were four institutions which were fundamental to shaping the character of the New Englanders, at least, so they could resist. They were, well, the town meetings, the schools, the militia, and the church, right? And so the militia was part of that. You were participating as an active citizen in the defense of your country. And in principle, every adult male was supposed to be part of that. This is before you had regular police force, too. What we call regular police force might look like a standing army from the perspective of the founding era. So every adult male was supposed to be part of the defense of your town and your colony when summoned to do so. That's how it worked. And they were very worried about the example of Rome as they learned the history. They thought when Rome switched to full-time professional soldiers and stopped having the typical Roman be responsible for defense, that's when you moved from republic to empire.
The relation of the famous midnight ride of Paul Revere to this engagement of Lexington and Concord. Tell us maybe not the full story, but a full-ish story about that ride and what perhaps some Americans don't know about it.
Okay, well, there are a few things. One is there was this nervous waiting game all winter, and the Provincial Congress was inland, and Gage was trying to figure out what exactly to do about things. It was getting rather tense. He was in Boston, and remember back then, Boston had a thin neck of land, and then it was just been filled in and to connect it to the mainland. And he finally got orders in early April to go after the Congress. Meanwhile, among the militia, they said they were training harder and harder. It was getting very tense. And what happens is he finally gets orders, yes, go attack. And what plan should they use? Well, Worcester, they decide, is 50 miles away, just too far, too hilly to have a successful operation where in Worcester there were more military stores. Concord was closer. And it's also where Congress was. Sam Adams and John Hancock were there. So they come with a plan to go after the provincials in Concord. They have to go through Lexington to get there. And they want to have absolute secrecy for this plan, of course, which that secrecy does not last. They are betrayed by various reasons. I mean, they've sent spies out to Concord, to scout the territory, and they were discovered. The Dr. Bliss, I believe it was, who entertained the spies, was found out, and he got very harsh treatment from the locals in general. But the other thing that happened is divisions in the town had been healed, so the town was fairly unified. And when the plans come through, finally, we're going to attack Concord, Gage tries to have complete secrecy. But the secrets betrayed is pretty obvious when his shock troops are told, oh, you're just taking the days off for rest. Everyone knows it's not really for rest. It's to prepare for battle. And so Paul Revere and Dawes they sneak out and get to Lexington. And at Lexington, I mean, Revere stops to get his horse changed. Horse can only ride so far.
Sure.
Around midnight. And he kind of starts to say the bells peal, the militia turns out. And he and Dawes are stopped by the pickets that the British has successfully set up. However, there's also a young Dr. Barrett from a relatively highly placed Concord family who was dating someone in Lexington. And he also had heard about this, I think, through them. I can't remember the exact story. But he was able to kind of jump the fence and take the back roads, which he knew very well, from going back and forth a lot to get the message to Concord that the British were coming through. So they stop at Revere and Dawes are stopped at Lexington, but Barrett gets the message all the way through. Meanwhile, the bells are pealing. The militia turns out it's a bit of a mess because the militia's there. Well, they keep waiting for the British to show up. They retreat to the tavern. They go out. They go back. And finally, in the morning, The British show up, and the militia is standing on Lexington Green, about 200 or so.
Mm-hmm.
The British command them to disperse, and some do, but many do not. And there's a lot of back and forth. It's not clear exactly how the first shots happened. You know, the prevailing testimony from the American side is that the British shot first, but shots are fired at Lexington Green, and then all secrecy is gone. The militia starts peeling in from all over the countryside. The bells are ringing church to church, town to town. See, that's how you send messages up and down the road. And at that point in time, the British then continue marching towards, and they march with music, you know, drums playing because it's too late. Into Concord.
We will return in a moment to talk more about Lexington and Concord with Richard Samuelson. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and today we're going to talk about the difference between discrete and discrete. I know that didn't help you out much, this being radio and all, so let's call one of these discrete double E, D-I-S-C-R-E-E-T, and the other one discrete single E, D-I-S-C-R-E-T-E. You might be thinking this is another one of those British-American spelling distinctions, but actually these are two completely different words. Discrete double E describes something you do on the down low. I am discreetly borrowing things from my parents' pantry when I go home to visit. Discrete single E is referring to non-continuous quantities. People, for example, come in discrete quantities because you can't really have half a people. I've seen a book where these spellings were used interchangeably. Don't be that person. Be discreet. That's your Grammar Minute. Visit thegrammarminute.com for more tips and tricks.
Welcome to the Old Ball Game, where we talk about the past of America's favorite pastime. I'm Tate Christensen. Today we talk about the first night game played in the MLB. In 1935, the Cincinnati Reds were a struggling team. They could hardly draw a crowd, averaging about 2,000 fans per game. The idea was presented to bring lights to Cincinnati's Crawley Field in attempts to bring more fans to the game. They thought that bringing in these lights would help the games to be played in the evening or at night so that people could come when they were off work. On May 24, 1935, a crowd of 20,422 fans gathered to watch the game between the Reds and the Phillies. From Washington, D.C., Franklin D. Roosevelt flipped the ceremonial switch, and lights turned on in Cincinnati, and the game was played. The Reds beat the Phillies 2-1 that night, and later in 1935, seven more night games were held in Cincinnati. Night games were later expanded to other teams in other cities. This has been the Old Ball Game on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Court is in session with Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Hello, my name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM, where I tell you all about the world's wackiest laws that are still on the books. Washington State is known for its lush forests, the city of Seattle, and, apparently, Bigfoot sightings. Skamania County in Washington has decided to take the supposed presence of Bigfoot seriously by passing an ordinance in 1984 that banned the hunting and killing of Bigfoot with a punishment of an up to $1,000 fine and possible jail time. This is not the first ordinance to help protect the life of Bigfoot. An initial ordinance was passed in 1969 that made it illegal to hunt Sasquatch, with a much more severe punishment of an up to $10,000 fine and up to 5 years in jail. In 1984, the City Council revisited the ordinance and decided to revise it. The decision followed an increase in activity in the area surrounding the search for Sasquatch. People were coming from all over to hunt the cryptid, causing some disturbance to locals. As a response, the county decided to make Skamania an official refuge for Bigfoot, especially since Bigfoot is classified as an endangered species. Don't worry, however, for all of you Bigfoot believers, it is still perfectly legal to go to the area to research and try and find the legend. Just keep it to pictures as proof. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Richard Samuelson, Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus, around the 250th anniversary of the Battles of Lexington and Concord. Dr. Samuelson.
So following that engagement at Concord, how did the retreat to the British forces to Boston proceed?
Well, not well for the British. The militia came in, they rallied, and back then, the regular troops march in uniform, in regular patterns down the road. The militia, of course, were irregular. Well, they were a militia, but they were perfectly happy to line up in the trees and the woods and around and start picking off troops, which the British, being professionals, regarded as cowardly. You're supposed to meet your enemy in battle, stand before them, and shoot them, right? And the Americans are picking them off all the way clear back to Lexington, where reinforcements arrived. Had they not showed up in Lexington, there would have been many troops left by the time they got back to Boston. And that angered the soldiers, the regular soldiers, the British, even more what happened, because they thought that is not fair play, right? It should be, if I'm going to be a regular soldier who is ready for battle on the field of battle, you should be that way as well. And this would be an ongoing theme with some of the mistreatment of the Americans by the British, different understandings of what it is to engage in war. By the way, Washington very much wanted to develop regulars. And by the time we leave Valley Forge, thanks to the great work of Baron von Steuben, we do have regular troops, but it's a quest because they were not really up to the standards of the full-time English troops.
Mm-hmm.
But the key story here, though, of course, is the British lost a lot of men on the retreat from Concord to Lexington. And then they retreat to Boston, where the siege starts. And militia from all over Massachusetts and then beyond start rallying in outside of Boston, and the British are holed up inside of Boston.
How would you compare, contrast the differences in tactics between the British and the colonial militias?
Well, as I said, the British were prepared for regular, they were regular troops from Europe used to the battlefields of Europe. They were used to facing off against the French in the battlefield, and there were certain rules of engagement that developed over the previous centuries. And, of course, this is part of the Age of Enlightenment, the effort to limit the ways in which one engaged in war. Washington, who was a colonel, was raised to a colonel in the French and Indian War, fighting in the backcountry in what's now probably West Virginia, parts of Pennsylvania, that area back there. He learned this just doesn't work in many parts of what's now the United States. This was still those areas that are more frontier-like. That way of doing battle simply is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
It will work, and Washington very much wanted that when he had pitched battles closer to the East Coast, but it was more situational. So you have a lot of anger is developed that the Americans are not just damn rebels, and of course, rebels are treated, people committing treason are treated like pirates. They should not deserve the laws of war, which would produce the mistreatment, the horrible mistreatment of American prisoners during the war that Washington would protest. And the Americans would learn perhaps the wrong lesson that, oh, our militia is sufficient to kick the British out. And of course, that really isn't enough. They would come in and they could help a lot, but there are cases where you really did need a well-trained, something like a professional army, which we did get through the course of the war.
Talking with Dr. Richard Samuelson about Lexington and Concord, April 19th, 1775, 250 years ago. How did Lexington and Concord perhaps influence public opinion around the colonies?
Well, it's interesting because John Adams thought, as others did, once the sword is drawn, throw away the scabbard. That is, there really is not much of a choice except independence. Others were much more reluctant, though they realized things are much more intense. And there was a plan after the first Congress, meet in the spring if necessary. Well, they're going to meet in the spring for the second Congress in May. So you're going to be a month after Lexington and Concord. And the result of that, George Washington shows up in his uniform. Well, hint, hint. Although Joseph Ellis said, well, maybe that was just his best fitting suit of clothes. Odds are no. And so the colonists have to decide. They are still colonists. What do we do? What's prudent? And their discussions in Congress, what does it mean? Because now you have an army of all these militia, but you don't have, they are not under any authority. So the first person in the Continental Army is Washington, who was nominated by John Adams. There's a lot of pushing and shoving. Should Massachusetts troops, New England troops be under a New Englander or not? And Adams, while the discussion is going on, finally says, look, I'm just going to nominate Washington. And that ends discussion. And Washington becomes the commander in chief. And then from there, he's going to try to take over these troops. And he's not entirely impressed by the troops. They're not what he would like. New England troops are not used to obeying commands like normal troops. They're used to electing their officers, which is not terribly good for the chain of command. But Washington would learn to appreciate their virtues during the course of the war. But when the Congress meets, they have to figure, what do we do about this army? We are now at war. What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a big move in public opinion towards, okay, now things are really serious. The British independence is kind of the back of people's heads, is the front of people's heads for those who kind of think, well, it's too late to fix anything. But the fundamental contours of the discussion have changed now. And now, are they just rebelling? Can they keep fighting till the British stop? Or are you going to have to take the next step? That's kind of the background of every discussion they have.
As we close, how should we remember, or what lessons perhaps should we draw from looking back on these events on April 19th, 1775, Lexington and Concord?
It's interesting, the memory of Lexington and Concord used to be school children would all learn the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April, 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. That is not part of our regular education anymore. And one lesson is how we remember these things, the memory of the revolution as part of our common civic understanding is fading. Maybe some of this discussion, the 250th, will bring some of that back. Because it's part of being a country that you have your common stories you share. And we've lost that in a world where, you know, not long ago, Johnny Horton gave a song about the Battle of New Orleans and people would know what it was. That wouldn't work anymore. We've lost that common history. So just like Lexington and Concord, other great battles and fights, we have lost that element of our history. So that's one element, is it's important to know this. It's important to remember Lexington and Concord, the other, and the finally, what's this about? It is about free government. The British were trying to replace free government with military government. And our right to self-rule, the democratic process, we call the democratic process, they would not call it that, but electing your own leaders, participating, public discussion, that's being part of the militia is the same thing. We defend ourselves. That's all part of the same story of equal independent citizens who are part of a larger community.
Dr. Richard Samuelson, Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus, as we talk the 250th anniversary of Lexington and Concord, April 19th, 1775. Dr. Samuelson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Up next, historian George Nash joins us. We'll talk about the significance of William F. Buckley, Jr. during this, the 100th anniversary year of his birth. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to KCNR 96.5 FM at 1460 AM, your talk radio. Online at kcnr1460.com.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Reading Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
We'd like to thank the Reading Rancheria for all their community support, including the bike shop. They do so much for our community, and we're beyond grateful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rancheria. You are the ones we can always count on to help us out in tough times. They're the people that have always been there for us, much more so than anyone else in our community. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
Need help with your health insurance? We've got you covered. At Shasta Community Health Center, we offer this free service to our community. Our enrollment counselors can assist you with new applications, renewals, troubleshooting, and answering your questions about covered California plans or Medi-Cal, also known as Medicaid or Partnership Health Plan. We're here to help you make the best choice for you and your family. Call our outreach and enrollment team at 530-229-5117 to get help today. Shasta Community Health Center, because SCHC cares.
9.9 million Americans misuse prescription drugs, with most of the pills coming from family and friends' medicine cabinets. The National Prescription Drug Take Back Day addresses this public health and safety issue. Help us keep prescription drugs out of the hands of our young people. Clean out your medicine cabinets and bring your unused, outdated, and unwanted prescription drugs to the Reading City Hall on Saturday, April 26, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. For more information, contact Chemical People at 241-5958 or chemicalpeople.org.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Now, this is Carl Bott
and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up, fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Reading Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Mimi Mosley here from Mosley Family Cellars. We'd just like to thank Reading Rancheria for their generous gift to us. It was so helpful and helped to keep us alive.
Hi, I'm Shelby Mahara with Squishy Doodle Face Painting, and I just wanted to say a huge thank you to Reading Rancheria for all of their support. They always help the community and always help to take care of us when they can.
Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Experience Glowing Wild, an illuminated wildlife lantern festival at the Sundial Bridge and Turtle Bay Exploration Park in Redding, California. Open select nights April 4th through June 8th, 7 to 10 p.m. Featuring 10 acres of illuminated gardens filled with Asian lanterns inspired by plants and animals from around the world. Plus food, drinks, live performances on select nights, and much more. Don't miss Turtle Bay's Glowing Wild Lantern Festival at the Sundial Bridge. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Have you ever wanted to unlock your musical potential? Cascade Curations not only has great music, art, and fashion, we also offer fun and exciting music lessons for all ages and skill levels. Whether you dream of playing the piano, guitar, drums, or vocals, our instructors will guide you every step of the way. With flexible scheduling and personalized instruction, you'll be playing your own tunes in no time. Don't just listen to music, create it. Call or text us at 530-255-4855 to book your first lesson. Cascade Curations, where we believe anyone can learn to play their own song.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends. The Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771 or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons, premium offerings, unbeatable value just for you.
Today would probably call a libertarian mm-hmm. or a free market conservative. And Buckley, as he lived at Yale and became a big man on campus, a famous debater and popular man in the social scene and all of that, Buckley, while personally popular, was very concerned and dismayed by the drift of things at Yale, particularly in the classroom. Keynesian economics, left-wing economics, was taking over in the teaching. Christianity was being de-emphasized and marginalized, and some of the professors and the faculty were openly disparaging of Christianity in the classroom. And he said, this is not what Yale used to stand for, and it seemed that there was a collectivist onslaught. And also it was being advanced, that onslaught, in the hallowed name of academic freedom, mm-hmm. so you couldn't really touch it. It just had to be that way. Buckley wrote a book called God and Men at Yale, which he published in 1951, which was his analysis and expose of these trends and his demand that something be done to reverse them. And he didn't just stop with documenting the collectivist and secularizing influence at work on the campus. He said that the alumni who had received an education from Yale and were, in a sense, the consumers of Yale's product, that they should rise up and impose a new orthodoxy on the liberal left-wing orthodoxy, which was taking root at Yale, a more Christian, free market-oriented orthodoxy, if you will. And that was a highly unusual notion at the time, and it caused apoplexy among many of the faculty at Yale and elsewhere. Well, he published a book in 1951, and it became a bestseller. Well, that was not probably his expectation. That didn't change things much at Yale, but it made him a national media sensation. The book became a bestseller, and here he is only 26 years old, shortly after the book appeared, so still a young guy. And it made him a leader or at the forefront of this kind of explosion, which got national attention. And it encouraged in him a desire to do something more than just write critically about it. And that something in 1955 became the founding of or creation of a magazine, his magazine, called National Review. And I have to stress to the listeners here, there was no other conservative journal of opinion in the United States at the time. And he wanted to make this a forum for intelligent conservative discourse and critique of these trends that they had been standing athwart for so long. He wanted to change the direction of things.
Because there was now something where there was nothing with National Review in 1955, was there a sense immediately that something was happening, that something was brewing among those who had these beliefs in the country?
Yes, there were three broad groupings of people who had been doing some writing in that decade after the war ended. In brief, we would call them traditionalist conservatives, like the Michigan author and distinguished conservative scholar Russell Kirk, free market advocates like Friedrich Hayek, who wrote The Road to Serfdom, mm-hmm. 1944, and then very strong anti-communist Cold Warriors, some of whom had been communists themselves earlier and had turned against it. So there were three thrusts, therefore, to what you might call conservative dissent. And Buckley's desire, his goal, his challenge, was to bring these three rather separate groupings together under one journalistic roof so that there could be a more coordinated and intellectually satisfying response to the left-wing predominance in the media.
Mm-hmm. George Nash is with us, author of The Conservative Intellectual Movement Since 1945, talking about William F. Buckley and the beginnings of the conservative movement. Your book, The Conservative Intellectual Movement Since 1945, at length examines two big questions. What, besides a common foe, would hold these groups together, these intellectuals together? So in essence, what is conservatism? And then what is conservatism in America? People can read the book to find the lengthy answer. Could you give us a short answer?
Yes. Well, conservatives came from all different directions, and they didn't necessarily have the same basic priorities. And there disputes arose among them between the traditionalists and the libertarians, to use the language of the categories. And so Buckley was looking for a way, and others with him at his magazine, to bring some blending of these perspectives together so that they could collaborate and also collaborate with some philosophical consistency. So there's a search for a kind of a philosophic underpinning for all of this. And secondly, they had to meet attacks from the left. Liberals have said, oh, conservatives, those are Neanderthals from Europe, no relevance to the United States. The United States has always been a liberal Lockean country, and these people are just flaky eccentrics. So what Buckley was trying to do was to show that there was intellectual viability philosophically, and also intellectual respectability, and also that America in many ways was a conservative country, and America had a tradition of freedom that ought to be conserved, if you will, an American tradition of limited government as opposed to ever-expanding government, the administrative state, the welfare state, etc. And also America was conserving the values of Western civilization, including the Judeo-Christian religious tradition, in the face of attack from the communists, who were atheists by definition, mm-hmm. and anti-capitalist by definition. And so communism was a threat that everybody, or opposition to communism, was something that all of these groups on the right could share. It was common ground.
George Nash is with us. We're talking about the significance of William F. Buckley and the early history of the conservative movement. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
At Cornerstone Community Bank, you're more than just a customer. You're our friends, neighbors, the local businesses where we shop, and the restaurants where we dine. Your success strengthens our community. Come meet our amazing teams in Reading, Red Bluff, and our newest location in Anderson, and find out why we are more than banking. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC and equal housing lender.
Hey Redding, save big on Black Bear Diner's new basket bundles. Get your paws on a choice of sandwich, side, and drink for only $10. A great meal at a great price. Basket bundles, now available at Black Bear Diner. Be sure to stop by for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Black Bear Diner just added 4 brand new and 4 returning classics to the menu. Black Bear Diner, 2205 Hilltop Drive. Get big value and so many choices at Black Bear Diner.
Black Bear Diner.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
I'm Gordon, Coach Master Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs, and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. George Nash is with us. He is an American historian, best known for being the author of the conservative intellectual movement in America since 1945. We're talking about William F. Buckley, his significance, and the beginnings of the conservative movement here in America. George, where did Buckley himself find the underpinnings for his philosophy?
I think they came from his family environment. I mentioned that his father was very conservative. It was a very conservative Catholic family, and Buckley said he never had doubts about his Christian faith. He was brought up a Christian. So that's one major source. His father was a businessman and therefore had some of the businessman's suspicion of overregulation by the state. Also, his father was kicked out of Mexico by Mexican leftists at the time of revolutionary ferment in Mexico in the late teens and early 20s of the 20th century. And his father was there ever afterward a staunch anti-communist, anti-radical, and all of those influences Buckley imbibed, you could say, at home. So when he went to Yale, he wasn't adrift. He had moorings, and he saw the college standing for things antithesis to what he had been brought up. And so rather than giving up his residual youthful conservatism and moving to the left, he fought the left, and that was unusual. But he had the kind of grounding that meant that he wasn't simply going to go with the winds.
Talking with George Nash, American historian, chronicler of the conservative movement, author of the conservative intellectual movement since 1945. In this first decade or so, say post-National Review, 1955, who's listening? Who's paying attention to these new conservatives in the U.S.?
Well, it starts small with 8,000 or 10,000 subscribers, but it obviously reached an audience rather quickly. Buckley's magazine became a kind of general staff for the development of was becoming conservative, more self-conscious conservatism. And this began to flourish, this phenomenon, in the early 60s with the rise of the Goldwater phenomenon. Goldwater, Senator Barry Goldwater, the Republican presidential candidate in 1964, had written in 1960 a book which sold, I think, 3 million plus copies, called The Conscience of a Conservative. And this is no secret, it was ghostwritten by Buckley's brother-in-law and best friend, a man named Brent Bozell. So there was popular awareness. And Kennedy comes in, John Kennedy, and he seems to be moving the country to what he called a new frontier, moving it to the left. And there is a resistance to that on the right. And National Review becomes the kind of the central magazine for disseminating that viewpoint in intelligent, persuasive ways. And Buckley, by the mid-60s, was on his way to becoming obviously a leader of this force, but also moving into the mainstream in various ways that we might discuss. He became a candidate for mayor of New York City in 1965 as a conservative. He didn't win, but he made conservatism much more visible and audible to a lot of voters, and that led a couple of years later to his being on the cover of Time magazine. It was a cover story for about him in 1967 with the caption, "Conservatism can be fun." And so he again was belying these older liberal stereotypes that conservatives could be just dismissed, unimportant, and so forth. And also, and quite importantly, in Buckley's development as a public figure, came about right after the mayoral campaign of 1965, in which he was very clever on the debates that the mayoral candidates had and so on. And so he made a name for himself. In 1966, he started Firing Line. It was a one-hour interview show, usually with one guest, in which they would discuss, hash out, and argue about all sorts of issues. He had a vast spectrum of people on that show. That was a very important breakthrough moment, I think, for Buckley personally and for the conservative cause. And I should just say, since we're talking to a media sensitive audience here, that show, Firing Line, lasted 33 years, yes. And Buckley had more than 1,500 episodes. The man was a worker. And he not only did that, but he influenced, I know, so many people who were impressed by his mental and verbal agility, his urbanity, his wit. He was very witty, very humorous. And all of this attracted many people to him, and it gave a hearing to his beliefs, you see. So Buckley, by the late 60s, was a leading national voice for conservatism and also a celebrity, even. He had broken out of that ghetto, you might say, of the right wing.
I want to back up to Goldwater for just a moment, because the Goldwater nomination and candidacy could be looked at as a great victory, because now these ideas are being seen on a national level. At the same time, the actual election itself could be seen as a big loss, because yes, Goldwater was wiped out. How does Buckley and this movement react to the reaction to Goldwater's campaign, yes, in 64?
Well, for one thing, Buckley wanted, and he started even before the election, to drive to the periphery of conservatism those who were really beyond the pale of respectability. In particular, he attacked the John Birch Society, which had a considerable following for a time in the early 60s. But it was built on the theory that the dangers that America faced in the world were the cause not simply of the communists abroad, but of communists within, who were distorting American foreign policy. And Robert Welch, the founder, claimed that President Eisenhower was, and I'm quoting now from memory, Welch's dismissal of Eisenhower as an conscious, articulate instrument of the communist conspiracy. And Buckley said, "You can't believe that. This is so ridiculous. This kind of conspiracy thinking, that's not going to get the movement very far." But the Goldwater campaign had several results. First, it disastrously defeated Goldwater, and it led to enormous Democratic majorities under Lyndon Johnson. So in public policy, the country lurched to the left, the Garriott Society. But the Great Society rather quickly ran into trouble, and so there was a reaction against it, and Buckley, of course, was there to articulate a strong conservative case against it. It also led to two other important factors going forward politically. One, it enabled the conservatives who had nominated Goldwater to take over the organizational machinery of most Republican Party state organizations. That's very important. Goldwater lost the election, but the party apparatus was now controlled by Goldwaterites, who would then be looking for some other candidate in the future. And thirdly, it created a new political voice for conservatism in Ronald Reagan, who gave that famous speech in support of Goldwater on TV just before the election. And it was so well done that it evoked, I think, millions of dollars in responses from people. And it made Reagan a national sensation.
So, yes, Ronald Reagan, who's a supporter of Barry Goldwater, speaks for Barry Goldwater. This politician who's a National Review reader and eventually ascends to the presidency in 1980.
Yes.
How much should we connect Reagan's ascendance, the Reagan agenda, to what Buckley began in 1955 with National Review?
Well, as you just said, Reagan read National Review from the beginning. The two men became acquainted in 1961, and their friendship deepened in time. And Buckley was articulating these core views of limited government, free market capitalism, and what we might call, in a way, social conservatism, and the defense of the social order against the unlawful attempts to disrupt it and so forth. Some of the turmoil of the 60s that was related in part to the Vietnam War protests and the like. So the National Review was really the central magazine, and Reagan was an avid reader of that. And Reagan was a reader. He was a student. People don't think of him that way, but I think the research shows it. So when all of that was happening, Buckley was there, in a sense, in an advisory role. And I have made the point elsewhere that Buckley was not quite a tutor to Reagan. Reagan learned from many sources, but Reagan learned from Buckley's magazine. And during Reagan's presidency, Reagan frequently received advice from Buckley quietly on personnel matters and other significant matters in running the administration. And it has been said by one of Reagan's biographers that Buckley was probably Reagan's closest advisor, really most trusted advisor outside the immediate official family of the president. So Buckley continued to have an influence that way, even though from 1980 on there were, you might say, two maestros, the maestro Buckley, and then now the political one implementing, you might say, some of the Buckley vision of things that occurred under President Ronald Reagan.
George Nash, American historian and chronicler of the conservative movement. His well-known book, The Conservative Intellectual Movement Since 1945. George, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Richard Samuelson from Hillsdale in D.C. and George Nash. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. As of October 1st, 1942, according to Kentucky Law Code, anyone who handles a reptile in a religious service can be fined anywhere between $50 and $100. Even with this deterrent in place, snake handling during Pentecostal church services remains as a practice in Kentucky's countrysides. Rattlesnakes tend to be the snake of choice, and as one would imagine, the practice can be dangerous, with multiple deaths having been reported due to these services. Additionally, members of these churches often refuse medical treatment in the instance of a bite for religious reasons. Kentucky is not alone in having these snake handling churches. The first recording of this practice was in Tennessee, and spread throughout Appalachia and beyond, even reaching Los Angeles, California. Snake-handling churches derive from multiple verses in the Bible, including a literal reading from a passage in the Gospel of Mark, which says, "They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." Coming out of the Pentecostal movement, which is a form of evangelical Protestantism, participants wish to feel a close connection to God. Members of these churches have claimed that those who have gotten bitten have handled the snake before it was spiritually ready. Services can also include speaking in tongues and other characteristics of Pentecostal churches. This particular law is rarely truly enforced, so much so that there have been several attempts at shows and documentaries following these churches. Reptiles and snakes are legal to own, and police have said in the past that they will not charge anyone unless a child becomes involved. So, next time you're in Kentucky, be wary of rattlesnakes, lest you have a spiritual experience and find yourself having to pay for it. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Mary, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the separation of church and state.
America's founders believed in the separation of church and state, in that the country was not to have an official religion or an official sect. But that did not mean that government was to be hostile to religion or even indifferent to religion, as many today argue. In fact, America's founding document, the Declaration of Independence, includes both a reference to God as the author of the laws of nature and a confident assertion that human beings are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Far from being hostile or indifferent to religion, America's founders understood the theology of the Declaration to be an essential part of the education of citizens.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.